Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale. Coming up next on the Wet Fly Swing Podcast.
If you're in shallow water, keep your rod angle lower, but lead more, keeping the tension on the flies. If you go more vertical, and typically a lot of times that water type is a little bit faster moving anyway, again, transitions from a shelf or a shallow riffle, you know, dropping into a pool, that sort of thing. So you can pull your flies just slightly or accelerate your rod speed a little bit more through the drift. If it's a little bit deeper, a little slower, then your rod is going to go more vertical.
That was Norm Moktaimo with a nice tip for your next nymphing trip. A deep dive into stillwater fishing and a bonus Euro nymphing segment today on the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the show. Did you know you can follow this show right now and actually get updated directly from your podcast when our next episode goes live? If you're on Apple Podcasts, you can do this by clicking that plus button in the upper corner of your app. Give it a shot. If you haven't followed the show, this will be a good chance to never miss a new episode. Today's episode is sponsored by Bear Vault, who has the perfect solution to keep your provisions secure while heading into the backcountry. Bear Vault builds a rugged polycarbonate locking canister that keeps bears and other wild critters out of your food. You can check out Bear Vault right now, wetflyswing.com/bearvault. That's BEARVAULT. And you support this podcast by clicking over to Bear Vault. We're also sponsored today by Lake Lady Rods, building distinctive custom rods, each created one at a time to the exact specifications for you. Lake Lady only uses top-of-line world-class components, great fly rods, and a great custom package. Please head over to wetflyswing.com/lakelady, LAKELADY, to support this podcast and a great local rod builder. Norm Moktaimo is here to walk us through the steps of preparing to fish a new stillwater. We discover how to analyze a lake before you get started, how the lock style can be more effective, and how to fish buggers and leeches. We're going old school on this one. This is a great one, so get ready for it. We've got a Euro nymphing and competitive world champion on the show today. So without further ado, here he is, Norm Moktaimo. How's it going, Norm?
Pretty good. It's early. Just real quick, to all of your listeners out there, this man is putting in the work for y'all.
Nice.
It's 6 o'clock a.m. his time, 7 a.m. my time. Dave's getting his work done for you guys, so
yep.
Shout out, Dave.
That's it, man. Thanks for that.
I'm here with you in the struggle.
I love it. Yeah, we got up early. You can probably tell from my voice it's a little bit, it's got the morning voice going. We've got another podcast right after this one with Ann out from UK, from Semperfly. So we're going to be like going across the world and, you know, we're starting here. Well, we're going to dig into where you're at and all that. And we're going to talk some about stillwater fishing, Euro nymphing, world championships. But before we jump into all that, take us into fly fishing. How did you first get into fly fishing?
Oh, man, how I got into it, actually, my dad is the one who got me into it when I was a wee tyke. Basically, about 7 years old is when I started fly fishing. I'd been fishing, you know, just conventional gear, casting bubble and a woolly bugger probably before that. But we did a trip to Yellowstone when I was about 7 years old, and he got me my first fly rod, and that just kicked it off from there. So that was, you know, just down and dirty how I got into fly fishing.
Yeah. So your whole life, and now where are you now?
Well, right now, you know, that's what, I'm 42, just turned 42. So that's how many years of fly fishing, guiding, competing in, with Team USA. And, you know, so just a lot of fly fishing adventures and experiences down the road here. But right now, you know, I currently live in New Mexico, Rio Rancho. I grew up in the little town of Pecos, which has the Pecos River that was 10 minutes from where we lived. And so, you know, those kind of backyard fishery type situation. Great thing about my childhood, you know, these were back in the times where parents were pretty lax and willing just to let you free out in the world. And as a kid, I would, in the summers, my dad would drop me off at the river or the lake, the local pond there, and along with a box of extra flies that I tie, and just let me loose for a day. And he'd come back, pick me up about four, or meet with me and go, and he'd fish for the rest of the afternoon with me. But yeah, I was slinging flies at the lake, selling them to people because they were watching me catch fish on them. So that's how and my time of fly fishing started.
That's it. That's cool. Right. And the Team USA is always interesting. We've had a number of people, probably I'm sure you were on your team when you're out there, you know, Devin Olson and Lance and some other folks. Yeah. So yeah, we're slowly ticking away. It's amazing. You know, I always love talking to you guys because you know, it's that upper level, right? I mean, the competition stuff is just a different ball game. How'd that come to be?
So I started on the youth team, U.S. youth team. It was the first year they had a World Youth Championship, which was held in Wales. That was for 1998. So in 97, the youth team, the organizers and coaches, they sent out inquiries to fly shops kind of around the country. And at that point, actually, I was already working at High Desert Angler, which is who I guide for right now. So I had started as a summer gig there, and I was 17, you know, just working a shop, filling fly bins and that sort of thing. And so my boss, she got word and recommended me. I think I was already back at school when they got the recommendation. Anyway, it just kind of snowballed from there. My high school advisor, he sent a recommendation. My dad had contacted him, and my dad had sent a recommendation some sort of note. And eventually it came to me where I had to send in a bio, you know, the usual, why do I think I should be on Fly Fishing Team USA, blah, blah, blah. And was selected out of, I don't know how many applicants, seven of us were chosen. And we made it onto Fly Fishing Team USA. And as a local note, I heard your podcast podcast, an interview with Taylor Strike.
Oh, yeah.
So Nick and I were on the same team that year.
Oh, wow. And so Nick was on the team. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. He was on the team for that year. So, yeah, both of us were on there. And, yeah, we made it out to UK. And funny thing is the adult team had already been competing since the early 80s. With no significant results, very different time for Team USA back then. And with our help, with the help of Davey Watton, who's pretty well-known wet fly guy, you know, amazing angler. But he's from Wales, so he came on as our assistant coach and helped us immensely. And then that was the intro to, well, back then it was a little more dialed in as far as like Czech nymphing, Polish nymphing. There was these different separations in nymphing styles, subtle, but you know, they were definitely proud of their specific techniques. So that's how I got into that. But we went to Wales, no high expectations from us or anybody else for that matter, because the adult team never did well.
No.
And ended up, our team finished in second. Wow. So we got a silver, and I won the individual gold that year.
Holy
so.
Cow. Was that the, what year was that?
That was 98.
Oh, wow, 98.
Yeah, so I was the World Youth Champion in 1998. The first medalist, I guess, for USA.
World, that's amazing. So, I mean, what does that feel like? I think I asked, I can't remember one of the other folks we've had on, you know, that same question, but what did that feel like for you on getting that gold?
I don't know, man. It was surreal for sure. You know, I wasn't expecting it, and just going in, having a good time, a kid from New Mexico, you know, rural New Mexico, desert state in Wales, competing in a fly fishing tournament. I was just amazed to be in Wales. It was everything I imagined kind of the UK being, you know, added on with some pretty good fishing. But no, it was amazing. You know, I always reflect back and just kind of, you know, wonder how things would have been if I hadn't had that opportunity. But no, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. And once you win that, what's the next step? Is that kind of catapult you in further into Team USA?
It did. So the coach, or basically the owner of Team USA at that time, his name was Walter Ungerman. He obviously got word of me, and our coaches kind of sent word up the line to the adult team. And I was the assistant coach in 99 for the youth team. So we traveled to Ireland, and I fished with Walter, and he basically just extended out, you know, if I was interested in competing with the adult team. And so kind of just left it at that. And I was like, yeah, sure. And in 2001, I was invited to be on the adult team. And then we traveled to 2001 was Slovakia. So that's where we competed there. Very different level of game there. You know, much bigger field. It's very different when you go from the youth, to the adult world championships. It's a much bigger platform. But yeah, and that's how it started. And then 2006 on, Team USA really started tightening up their competition series, qualifiers, and going through that process in order to garner a competitive team. And that's where you see Devin and Lance come in.
Mm-hmm.
And George Daniels, you know, all that crew.
You were there. You were there at the really the beginning, that transfer over from. And I'm trying to think who told the story, but we had that one where it was just a rough shot group of guys back in the day. And then
it was a
Jeff
good old
Currier,
boy.
Right? Jeff Currier maybe was Currier, there, and then
So Currier was on the team with me too back then.
Oh, okay.
So he was part of. He was before me. So when I came on, Jeff was already on the team, and so I had met him. And fished and competed with him. He's awesome, dude. Love Curry.
Yeah.
And then we progressed from there, and then it changed into getting more competitive. Courier was on the team.
That's cool. Nice. So, yeah, it's. I love the. Maybe we'll save a little bit of the Team USA for the end if we have time here. I want to dig in some on because I did have something. I know in 2018 there was, and this might play into some of the Stillwater stuff here. But I want to talk a little about Stillwater fishing because that's something that we don't always get a chance to talk a ton about.
Right.
And the cool thing here is you did it right with Team USA, so it's more.
Yeah.
Kind of, I don't know what you call that, right? More of a, I guess a competition style lake fishing. But can we do that today? Like dig into a little of like Stillwater and what that looks
for sure.
like? Yeah. And I'm thinking, what were the lakes? Because I know this came from Zach. He actually gave me a shout out to you. He was.
Right on.
Yeah. What's up,
Zach?
you know Zach? Yeah, totally.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Awesome. And Zach, he actually co-hosted an episode a while back. Yeah.
Question. Hey, Zach, where are the videos at, man? I'm missing the Flying Ties videos.
Nice.
Missing them. I love his videos.
There you go. Perfect. So yeah, but he kind of gave a shout out and it was a good point because I love Stillwater fishing and I'd love to hear more. I know it's a little bit different, but maybe we can talk about that. I think that was one of Zach's question was how do you fish or how do you approach a new lake, right? You're coming in this thing, you're looking around, the lake looks like there's, how do you know where to start? What's your strategy there?
Right. Lakes, Stillwater for Americans is very daunting and exactly. It's a blank piece of paper and you're mm-hmm. like, all right, now what do I do?
Yep.
It can be very simple or as simple as just reading the contour of the land that you're standing on for the most part. So, if you're fishing from the bank, which, most people, they may not have a boat or anything like that to access, to get out away from the shore. But, when you're looking at, banks and that sort of thing, look for any ridges. Drop-offs, boulder fields, and again, it's when you're looking at Stillwater, it's definitely more structure-based. Just like just like you would do on in a river too. You know, you're reading the structure of the and the contour of the river bottom to kind of help you determine where the more likely spot for a trout to hold would be. However, when you're dealing with still water, instead of trout really holding and focusing on one specific spot, they do cruise, you know, they cycle through a territory. So that can be a little disheartening when you're fishing and, you know, all of a sudden you're just kind of like, man, I don't know if there's anything here. And then, you know, you just kind of got to sit and wait and because they'll come back through and then you finally get one. But when that happens, make the most of it. Get your cast back, get that fish landed, get your cast back out there because you may find a few more within that little pod. So a lot of it is searching out pods of fish sometimes. Mm-hmm. But that's a pretty simple way to kind of break down initially what you need to look for.
Yeah, that's the first thing. So you're saying you look on the land, and if there's a steep slope coming into it, you know, you probably know it's going to be a pretty deep area versus, say, there's a boulder patch on the bank and that there's probably some boulders down in the water, that sort of stuff.
Right, right. And it depends on your species of trout, too. Rainbows, you know, they're going to behave a little more differently than browns. You know, browns, I find, do like the bigger ambush points. You know, they can be more of an ambush type predator in stillwater situations. Your rainbows, you know, they can be a little bit more kind of losing the word pelagic for lack of a better word.
Oh, right.
You know,
they're like out cruising.
Just cruising, exactly. So yeah, they can be a little bit more scattered. But look for those high points, those ridge lines that enter water that can create a nice underwater point. And then if your water visibility is decent enough where you can see any drop-offs or shelves, work those transition points, just like you would work a shelf in a river.
Again,
it just creates those opportunities for, either bait fish or aquatic insects to congregate, but at the same time gives the fish, access to escape and evade predators.
Right. So. Right, right. That's key. And how did it work? Was it 2018 when the Nationals were in Eastern Oregon?
Yeah, that's correct. 2018.
Yeah. And what was that? What did you guys do there? Was that something where you were kind of, well, that's probably your home. You probably knew some of those lakes or not?
No, actually. Well, we had been to Bend a few times for regionals and another national championship. But that year, I believe the team was intending to go to Wales for world championships, which was going to be all lakes. So a lot of times what Team USA does is they gear their regionals or their nationals in particular of that year of the world championships to match or mirror the water type they would be fishing. So Wales was intended to be primarily all still water. And so we did our national championships to be primarily all still water, although they had the Upper Deschutes in the mix there too. But I think we were on Lava Lake and Crane Prairie.
Oh, nice.
One of the Twin Lakes, yeah. So we had never fished Crane Prairie before, which was awesome. I do like that lake a lot. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, so, Crane's awesome.
But yeah, so that's how they came up with, obviously, the venues for that world, national championship.
That's how they did it. What was it like when you came into Crane, or maybe take us into that national and the lake? So how are you approaching Crane Prairie? You haven't fished it before. It is a really amazing lake. It's got big fish and a lot of food.
Yeah, so, you know, and this actually goes, obviously, you wanted to wait to get into Team USA stuff, but this is
keep going
together.
Yeah.
So
yeah, definitely.
You know, with these competitions, you're especially with nationals, you're rolling in as a team. So you have a team of five, and so we spend and dedicate time before the competition to go and look at venues. Competition venues are off limits for about 60 days prior to the competition. And so we can go look at it, and if they have any of the venues set up, that's what we're looking at, the specific competition section and mapping out what we got going on there. As far as the reservoirs and lakes, they give us typically, I think, scheduled time slots for teams to go out and look at the lakes. So, you know, you can sign up for this time frame and get a boat, possibly if you need to get a boat, or if it's a what they call a lock style session. So you're out in a boat. You can get a boat and go out and look around. You know, you're mapping, just like what I was mentioning, mapping those drop-offs, those points, those windbreaks, and all this. So that's how you're just getting the initial overview of what you're looking at. And then, you know, if it's a bank session, you're looking at what your bank contours could be, because, you know, you're standing on the bank and you rotate on those beats. So, you know, you're not just sitting in the one little section kind of.
Yeah. Were you in the boat or were you doing on the bank on this one?
You do it all, basically.
Oh, so, you do it all.
Southwind, I think it was a bank session, lava crane, and the other reservoirs that we were on were boat sessions, lock style sessions. So you got to be versed in kind of all of it, really, how to work from the bank and how to work out of a boat. And then Google Maps, you know, Google Maps is huge. You know, doing a lot of that aerial mm-hmm. reconnaissance. mm-hmm. So that's how we spend a lot of time doing a lot of research before we go into these competitions. Not necessarily looking at the lake itself physically, but, you know, again, through online yeah. resources as well. And local knowledge, you know, a lot of times we'll hit up either guys that we know that live out there, fly shops, other guides, you know, so.
Yeah, that's right. So that's it. So just like, somebody listening now could be thinking like, you know, you're heading out to a new lake, and that's always a good thing, right? Call a local fly shop, talk to a guide, get
exactly.
some info. So you get that, get the Google Maps going. So once you get, so now you probably have some flies, you probably know what you might be using, some hatches. Once you get to the lake, you know, maybe you could take us to how that worked with the competition, or just talk in general. Let's take Crane Prairie, right? You get there, you haven't fished it before. What's your first step?
So going back to what you had already gathered as far as intel, you know, looking at maps and just a brief overview of the lake, you know, you hit your most likely spots. So, you know, again, those ridges that extend out, you kind of work through there. But granted, and keep in mind, when you're fishing in these competitions, especially in lake sessions, especially on a boat, you have another competitor that's on the boat, not your teammate necessarily, but another competitor. So you're competing against the guy in the boat. However, it does help and benefit both of you to work together in a sense to figure this out, because obviously if one does well, the other guy should do well also. But one competitor will have captainship of the boat. And so for the first half of the session, so they'll say, I want to go in this area and, you know, work through there. But a lot of times, you know, you just end up sharing, well, you know, we kind of look at this spot over here and this could be something worthwhile to check out too. And you really kind of eliminate, you don't spend a lot of time in one spot if you're just like, man, all right, this is, with temperature, you know, sunlight applications and stuff like that. Time of year, again, you know, you're looking at your hatches and that sort of thing. You know, if it's earlier in the spring, a lot of times these fish are just opportunistic and wanting to feed on, you know, bugger type patterns. UK, they call them lures. And, or as you get further into summer, early fall, you're dealing with damsels, you know, it could be in chironomid sessions, calabatus, a lot of other varying food availabilities there. So,
yeah.
So I think when we were there, you know, buggers was kind of the name of the game. As long as, you know, you're being opportunistic or getting that opportunistic behavior out of the fish, that worked well for us.
That was it. That's so awesome that you guys on a competition, you buggers were the name of the game.
Yeah, they're a little more fancy though. So
yeah, what were they? How are they different from your normal woolly bugger with the three?
So you know, a lot of them are tied with varying material. They're not like your traditional woolly bugger with the olive or black chenille. You know, they look very similar. They could be a lot of them tied like Pops bugger style. If you're familiar with that fly, it's tied with Palmer chenille, still a marabou tail, but maybe two toned. And you know, you're dealing with a lot of UK type bugger patterns, humongous type flies. Humongous is the name of the pattern.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Yeah. So it's a humongous, for those of you who don't know, it's just a standard woolly bugger, but tied with either some silver or gold crystal flash chenille or crystal chenille. And the tail typically is about three times the length of the body. normally the body is never bigger than a size 10 or 8 short shank. So, yep. You know, short shank hook. But just tons of movement in the tail when you extend it out. And people always are, you know, suspicious whether or not fish hook up well because of the length of the tail. The tail being marabouts, super soft, and a lot of times these fish are going for the head of the fly anyway. So they're already at the hook and you don't miss too many. But nice thing with marabou, if you are getting those little short strikes, which happens normally mostly with stalkers because they're just nipping, tasting, and trying to figure out the world, you can, with marabou, you can just pinch the tail off and shorten it down, and you know, that maximizes your hookup ratio. So,
oh, there you go. And so you're saying that the tail, typically you're tying these things that are like twice or three times as long as the body?
About three times, yeah.
Yeah, three times. Yeah, so that's huge. So that definitely is longer than, you know, I think sometimes, yeah, two times, but three is great. So that's a long.
Yeah.
And then I'm looking at the, I'll put some links in the show notes here for the Pops Bug and that the humongous fly.
Yeah, exactly. So, and, you know, some other things that people are learning more about, blobs and boobies, but blobs is definitely a big one for us. Daphnia, and, you know, and it's supposedly supposed to represent Daphnia in the water, but as your blobs, you know, they're just a really bright attractor type egg looking pattern, you know. So yeah. You tie a little foam in the butt and it creates a different movement in the fly, but especially when the blob gets down lower, you have loss of UV light or certain color spectrums get lost. And so you're, you know, if it's a bright orange blob, it actually turns a green color. So that's where it more or less matches Daphnia a little bit more. You know, Daphnia, they're really tiny. They're, you know, tiny aquatic, what are they, Chris? Bug.
Yeah, it's a good question.
I haven't gotten down into Daphnia as much as on any other aquatic insect, but they do swim together in like little clumps and clusters, and so trout just kind of roll through and just gulp them up like a whale to krill, you know. So
yeah,
they just kind of vacuum them down. But that's one thing that blobs do. But no, that game, that lake competition was definitely a lot of lures, or what I,
yeah, you know, big stuff
called woodpeckers. So that's what we were running. Rain Prairie was awesome, you know. So we ended up finding a lot of fish and more of the shallow stuff where all that down timber that's in there is.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. So you know, maximizing, there's brookies and rainbows, and you know, it was fun. So Lava was a little bit different, a little more damsel flyish, if you will, because a lot of the weed beds are starting to go. And so you're looking for stuff like that. As the day progresses, fish will hold different levels in the water column. So in the morning they were higher, at least a foot to 3 feet down was their main feeding area. And as the session progressed, about the last hour, they had dropped. And that could have just been us pressuring the fish too. They dropped down another couple feet. And my boat partner at that time, he was underneath the fish for majority of that session. He didn't change anything. He had a heavier line than I was fishing. So I was running a slow intermediate line. And so I was in the zone majority of that time. And as that last half hour, I didn't change my line weight in enough time. And he was able to catch up and tie with me and beat me that session by like a centimeter or two, something like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was pretty hurt.
Huh. Man. So
he's a good buddy. He actually lives down here a few miles from me. His name's Ron Kless. But we always give each other crap about that when we're fishing together. But he was in a video that I did not too long ago. But
okay.
He's a good dude.
Nice. And you have like a YouTube channel there?
I do. And my time of fly fishing also. Okay. So a lot of these techniques and stuff with Euro nymphing, still water stuff, although I need to do more still water stuff, do touch on a lot of my videos. They're not just necessarily me going out and just, you know, fishing. I've tried to explain what I'm doing, and it's, you know, on the water situations. So I come across what I see, what I'm doing, and I'll approach, you know, approach it as if you were with me and you know, work through it.
This episode is sponsored by Rare Gear, not only making telescoping fly rods, but rethinking the whole fly fishing kit as we know it. This rod is a blend of traditional and Tenkara styles to make a super highly packable rod that fits literally in your pocket. I have this thing going everywhere with me. It's in my backpack. It's always there, throwing it down. You sometimes forget about it, but when you need it, you can break it out and fold that thing out in a matter of seconds, and you're good to go. Rare also has a folding net, some compact wading booties to go along with their telescoping fly rod. They've also got a Tenkara rod. So a number of things going on at Rare Gear. They're a unique as it comes. So if you want to see something, if you want to see a rod that has no guides, that pops out and telescopes out in a matter of seconds, and is a quality rod, check out Rare Gear right now. You can do that by heading over to raregear.com and find out what this rod is all about. Coming from the founder, Derek mentioned this is definitely a weird, one-of-a-kind rod. So check it out right now, Rare Gear, R-E-Y-R-G-E-A-R.com. You support this podcast by clicking over through that link. So when you're fishing that fly, like that woolly bugger style, you know, and it sounds like just an intermediate sink tip, how are you fishing it? Like on crane, how'd you fish that? And this was out of a boat?
Yeah, so we were out of a boat. And actually, so my whole setup, if you want me to break that down.
Yeah, go for it.
A lot of these lake sessions, we're fishing either 6, 7 weights, some guys even 8 weights, 10-foot rods. So a lot of length. One main reason, well, there's a couple reasons, but one main reason is in competition, we're not allowed to stand in the boat. So we got to cast sitting in a sitting position. So, you know, having that extra length helps carry the line up high over the boat that we were not smacking each other. Although it does happen every once in a while, getting hit behind the head with a 200 mile an hour traveling bug fly through the air. So yeah, that can happen, but that's intended to help, keep the cast above you. And then at the same time, as we're pulling in or retrieving our flies, once we get to a certain point close to the boat or towards the end of the retrieve, you start to lift your rod and hang the flies away from the boat. So having that extended rod helps you do that without, you know, being any closer to the boat than you need to, which is a very, very deadly maneuver at the end of your retrieve. So you just kind of suspend your fly there for a few seconds, if not even longer, and kind of, you know, animate them a little bit, jig them, that sort of thing. So,
And how far below surface are you doing that?
You can see your flies at that point. Yeah. So depending on the clarity of the water, they could be, you're drawing them up depending on what sink rate line you have. You're drawing them up from whatever depth they are and then just hanging them. And you can see the fish coming around and, you know, you just start messing them like a cat with a little toy, you know, you just kind of start, you know, animating and you see them start around it, pause, yank it up, you know, let it drop back down. You're just doing everything you can to get this fish to eat.
Yeah.
And it's pretty exciting. And a lot of times you're able to get them to eat right at the end there.
There you go.
So
are you doing the figure eight? It's kind of like the...
No. Trout aren't as... they're a little more spooky than pike or muskies when you're trying to do the figure eight.
Yeah, there you go.
But so you're working a sinking line, and like I said, I was fishing. And normally we do utilize more full sink lines and sink tips, especially when you're casting at distance. It helps you stay in the zone. Because one thing, when you're in a boat, you're not anchored. So in lock style fishing, break that down too.
Mm-hmm.
In lock style fishing, your boat, you have competitors on both ends of the boat. And if you have a controller who measures and makes sure the competitors are following the rules, he sits in the center, just like where a guide would be on a dory, if you're, you know, on a drift trip. So, but your boat stays perpendicular to the wind. So, you're drifting downwind with both anglers facing downwind, casting downwind. So there's no trolling. You're not allowed to fish behind the boat, letting your flies drag with the current. And a lot of times, tied to the boat is a drogue or a water sock, wind sock, if you will. So it helps slow the boat down a little bit more. So you're actually able to manipulate and get the retrieve speed you want. But because you're moving downstream and you're retrieving downwind, your boat is drifting downwind, you're retrieving back towards the boat, depending on the speed you're drifting, that can affect your sink rate. So if you have a faster moving boat with a lighter line, you're staying really high in the water column because you're having just to really strip fast to maintain contact. If you're trying to animate your flies or create any movement in your flies, you're really having to double up on your speed in order to get that fly to move. But that reduces your time in the water, basically, because your fly are coming together quickly. So one thing that'll help you if you need to get down deeper is going to a heavier rated sinking line. So from an intermediate type line down to like a type 6 or a 9.6, which is theoretically 6 inches per second its sink rate, which is a pretty fast sinking line. That's really fast. It may keep you in that upper 3 to 5 feet because of the speed you're having to retrieve and the rate your boat is drifting towards your flies. So you may not be getting the same depth as if it was blowing slower or no wind. You know, at the same cast, your fly starts to sink because you don't have to speed up to keep contact with your fly. That die six will get down a lot further. And same with your intermediate. You know, your intermediate, you're trying to focus on that upper 3 feet of the water column in a lot of situations. So it depends on the distance you cast and your speed of retrieve, you know, where your fly stay in the water column. And that's all defined where those fish are actually feeding, which can be different from where they're holding to where they're feeding. So they may hold down and come up to eat. Or, you know, if they're just in that total feed mode, you know, you got bugs and insects moving around, you can stay in that zone a lot longer and produce more fish.
That's it. So, and take it back, you're fishing the intermediate line. How are you finding the level that they're at? What's the easiest way? So if you got a 12-foot deep body of water, how do you know where you're at?
It's a lot of time with the line itself. This countdown method is good. So if we're trying to map out and find where these fish are, I usually start with 5 seconds as soon as I lay the cast down, and then I'll start my retrieve. So I'll do at least 2 or 3 of those. After about the second or third cast, I'll switch my retrieve up just to see if the retrieve has something to do with it. Do about a couple more of those, and then if that doesn't really produce, I'll count down further to 10. And then from there, it'll be a 10 count increment, if you will. So 5 to 10, 10 to 20. If I finally find a fish, if it's deeper than any of those, 30 or such, and my retrieve has some speed to it, you know, or a lot more pull or animation, then I'll switch to a heavier sink line so it gets down quicker and sooner. That way I'm in the zone a lot longer, and hopefully trying to produce more fish. So that would be when I would make the line change. So keep in mind, if you get into this lock style still water situation, you're going to buy a lot of spools, extra spools for your reels. So don't spend a lot of money on the reel because you got to get a bunch of spools for it. To have all the different sink rate lines in order to find, because you're not really, it's not like a suspension rig where you're changing the depth and just lobbing it out and letting a floating line, because obviously you don't want to run a sinking line with that. So you just need the one type line to do it. This is a lot different when you're having to pull and retrieve your flies, keeping them in the zone with those different sink rate lines.
Yeah, that's a great point. So the retrieve, so when you cast it out there, once you're kind of getting your depth to find the fish, and then what are your different retrieves you might be doing here?
So standard, 8 to 12 inch pulls, the speed or the intervals of your pulls can vary. Figure eight retrieve, so just kind of creating a nice steady pulsing retrieve depending on the speed you do the figure eight, or just long, slow. All you're doing is maintaining contact with your flies. So a lot like with how they would fish chironomids, but I even do that with a lot of lures or bugger type patterns, you know, nymphs, especially if you're dealing with any calabatus or anything like that. So just drawing a really long, slow pull, just the length of your arm pull and your arm span basically behind you, and then coming back up and then just continuing again. So, and then you have other retrieves like roly-poly where you're those fish do want some speed. A lot of times that's with a lot heavier sinking line. So you're getting down deeper, you know. So especially if you're dealing with, if there's a lot of bait fish in the water, trout do take advantage of that a lot of times. And so a roly-poly retrieve can get him to trigger.
There you go. What lines are you using here? So you mentioned a few sink lines. So how many sinking lines do you have in your, how many extra spools do you have?
Oh man. Right now I probably have about 12 spools, extra spools. So, you know, and they're anything from, so Airflow is one of my favorite, sinking lines, being a UK company, and the Euros definitely do very well in the lake competitions. You know, they definitely push the or created that world. So their lines are really great. They have two different sinking rate intermediate lines, so you can really stay right in the surface film or go down just a little bit further in you know, that top water column. They have an intermediate sink tip. But, you know, then you go from there, type 3, type 4, type 5, type 6, type 7. And then, obviously, floating line. Rio has a great midge tip that I like. I don't know if I haven't seen if they still make that line anymore. It has, like, 3-foot midge tip on it. I do like that line quite a bit. And then you have actually some other sink tip lines. So either another, it's like I said, an intermediate sink tip or other sink rate sink tips. So, you know, you just have a variety of different lines. My go-tos, honestly, is that either the intermediate lines, type 3 or type 5. I really don't branch out or need to go to those other lines a lot of times. Yeah. So, but you know, situations may call for that specific tool for you to use. And especially in competition, I've definitely made the mistake of not rolling with all my gear. You're like, oh, I don't think I'll need that. You know, conditions, you know, thinking I know everything. And I get out there, I'm like, dang it. I should have had that line, or I should have brought that box of flies. You know, just roll with everything, have it all with you.
Yeah, just bring it all. Yeah, you're in a boat. Well, if you are in a boat, yeah, it's good. It's pretty easy to throw in a bag.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So, okay. And so we're floating. I'm just, you know, in the boat again. I'm trying to think the difference between the, so describe that again when you're floating down with the lock style. So you've got the boat perpendicular to the wind. And,
right.
And so is there somebody, so there's somebody's rowing it, keeping it perpendicular to the wind? Well, is that kind of how we're working here?
Typically there is, you know, so, but if it's what we call competitor controlled, so you have two anglers on a boat, but no controller, usually you set the drogue or the water sock out, and that, you can tether in a way, either closer to the bow or closer to the stern, so it'll drift true, and then you don't really have to do much in order to manage the drift. Yeah, exactly. So that that drift sock does a lot to help manage the drift on its own. However, it can be a lot more of a challenge if you have some squirrely winds. You know, you get a lot of these lakes are in bowls or depressions, and so you have winds coming in and they switch direction on you, and that can be a, you know, a bit of a cluster when you're having to deal with that. But you know, you got to deal with
it. Yeah.
So. But yeah, your boat is set up so you're perpendicular, you're casting downwind. Competitors, they'll have to the middle of the boat, to the bow or stern, off 90 degrees off the bow or stern. So that's your quadrant that you're allowed to fish, so, legally anyway. So
yeah,
you're trying to stay in that realm.
90 degrees, okay. So you got that area in the front. And so what is the advantage of the having the kind of the wind sock and that out there versus, say, just, I mean, what were the other way? I guess trolling, right, is one way to do it. What's the advantage?
Trolling or anchoring, you know. Really what it does, it allows you to cover water. Again, you know, you look at the behavior of trout in still water. They're cruising. They don't stay stationary. So if you do have a decent breeze going, a lot of times they create, the wind does create like little drift lines. So you make your cast, you can find these little wind lines that are created, and you can work those wind lines. They're almost like an eddy. So you're just working your way downstream, working that those wind lines. So what the fish do is they'll go down to the basically start of a wind line or the downwind portion of the wind line and just cruise up the wind line. You'll see like the foam is home, you know, like you would see on the eddy, seam of an eddy. And so you can work it that way. However, at the same time, what it allows you to do too is if you do find a pod of fish, you work through them, you may catch, you know, one or two. And as you drift past, you can use the boat to maneuver, get back out and around and try to relocate them again. If you kind of feel like they're moving, you know, east to west or whatever, you can reposition the boat and try to work through that pod again and pick up a couple more. So, but also drifting across a point, stuff like that. It just allows you to cover more water, cover fish. And obviously you want to cover new fish, because they'll be a lot more willing to feed and take your flies. So.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, we were up in a BC last month, and we were kind of doing something similar. We didn't have the windsock, but there's some fish working like kind of towards the bank, and it was just me and another guy in the boat, and he would be rowing, and then the wind would slowly be pushing us down, and you know, we'd get within the bank so we could cast towards the bank. Yeah, it was
right.
Like every time you made that cast, you know, towards the bank, you give it a few, kind of stripped it, working it in. It was like fish on.
And exactly. You're being, you know, somewhat stealthy working, you know, letting the wind push you rather than relying on trolling motor or rowing constantly.
Yeah.
You know, you can kind of just adjust, tweak with the oars a little bit.
Exactly.
And get dialed in. Really.
That's why it's fun.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's why it's fun. It is fun because the trolling is, you know, you're trolling. It's kind of like you're always rowing, but actually having the wind, using that, yeah, it's way more peaceful and kind of easier to do.
Yeah, exactly. And trolling is lame.
Yeah.
You do catch fish doing it though, but yeah, you're just kind of sitting there. It's just, you know.
Yeah, trolling is boring. Yeah, you don't want to troll. So no trolling. And what is the windsock? Where would somebody, or no, I'm calling it a windsock, but what's the name of it?
Drift sock.
Yeah, drift sock. Where would somebody get one of those?
Cabela's has them. I think Devin has, I think he used to carry them on Tactical Fly Fisher. You can find them a variety of like marina type, websites. And depending on the size of your boat, you know, people they have recommendations on sizes, for a certain size boat. I feel like a lot of those are undersized. I would say for this application, do get at least a size or two bigger. That way it'll really slow your boat down and allow you to achieve that speed that you want. Yeah, you don't want your boat, you know, accelerating any faster than you need to. Basically, yep. It prevents you from struggling to keep contact with your flies as you're retrieving. So it'll help keep that speed you want.
Keep it going.
Yep.
Is it okay to use that with like any boat? I think, you know, a drift boat is that okay to use? Or
oh yeah,
is it, yeah.
It can be a challenge to find that sweet spot for the drogue is what they call it. Drift
yeah,
sock,
drogue. Drogue. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the other term. So positioning your drogue on the boat, especially if you have like a classic high side or anything like that, where you have the bow pointing up higher than the stern, positioning the drift sock to where, because what your boat will end up doing is it'll camber depending on, you know, the speed of wind. So it may cock to one side and just start drifting that direction rather than going straight down 90 degrees. So, you know, spend the time to just kind of either pull the drogue towards the bow or towards the stern, and that'll straighten out the boat for you. So you just got to get accustomed to doing that, you know,
yeah,
boat to boat, basically. You get a skiff or something that's a lot more level, you don't necessarily need to do that all the time. Weight distribution in the boat can factor in as well. So you got a big guy on the bow or a big guy on the stern, you know, that'll change your drift as well. So that'll shift your position of the drogue off the boat. So
yeah. What were you guys, what was the boat you guys are using out there when you're doing that, or crane, or what do you typically use for your lake boat?
Crane Prairie had a marina, and so they just some John boat style, which are perfect. They're great hard hull, shorter boats. A lot of times what we do I forget what they call them, but basically it's a little bench board that you can put into the boat. So it sits on the gunnels of the boat. So you sit up higher. Again, remember, you're not allowed to stand, but you can prop yourself up.
Yeah.
So, and if you have skiffs, you know, drift boat skiffs, so they're a lot shallower design. Those are a lot nicer because you can keep your rod down closer to the water for your retrieve. So a lot of the high side boats and that sort of thing are horrible because you have to reach over the top of the gunwale in order to get your rod tip down and get your retrieve the way you want it, which can inhibit a lot of your retrieve styles. So, Crane Prairie had a marina that had identical John boats. So it helps when you're dealing in a competition, trying to keep an even keel for all the competitors. So boats is one thing too. You get a lot of regionals, and I've hosted regionals here, and you know, you're just trying to pull as many volunteers and have as many of them bring whatever boat they got, and you got all these boat styles, and you know, obviously if somebody's not winning, they're going to blame something other than themselves. So the boat just,
yeah, it's always the boat.
The boat. Exactly.
Yeah, I know. That is a good tip on the boats, because the drift boats are high sided, but those lower skiffs are really cool. So the skiff would be a good lake boat to use.
It would. They are pretty flat. You know, so very easy to fish out of. A lot of times too, find something that's clean, meaning, you know, no, very few snag points. So rafts are horrible with casting platforms and that sort of thing, because they have all those little buckles and, you know, screw down points for the frames and all that. Just a lot of stuff for your line to get tangled around. One tip for folks that are out in boats fishing these techniques is take a wet towel, a beach towel or something like that, and just get it damp and lay it down like a casting deck, casting platform. So it gives you a clean surface to cast. And so when you strip in your line, it's not wrapping around all this other stuff. It's just laying down on that top.
All right.
Yeah. So
there you go. That's another good tip. Well, before we move off of the Stillwater stuff here, any other tips you want to throw out? Maybe a couple more tips. You've given here quite a few good ones. If you're, let's say, take it back to Crane. You know, somebody's getting ready to fish Crane. Let's say they have a boat. They've got a skiff or a John boat. They're heading out there. What else would you tell them to try to find some fish?
One big tip is keep your head on a swivel. Obviously, you're not, if you're pulling flies, you're not throwing dry flies most of the time. So if you're retrieving, you know, you're maintaining contact, keep your head on a swivel, always look around. You like a lot of other fish, you may see fish rising, and if the rise forms are congregated or a lot closer together, that may give you an idea that there might be, you know, a pot of fish over there. Or, again, you know, like saltwater stuff, nervous water can give away positions of fish. If they're sitting just under the surface feeding, you know, that could be a good number of fish sitting in there. But one fish could give away several other fish, you know, so always keep your head on a swivel. I remember one time we were competing on Rudai Reservoir, and the lake was off color. It was that, you know, red color of the clay and sand or dirt, the soil that's around there.
Yeah.
And they had some heavy rains, or it was just runoff time. I think it was post runoff. So runoff was coming down, but the lake was still pretty off color. So anyway, we're trying to figure out where these fish were hanging out. We're working all the usual stuff, the bank edges, points, and we were struggling, you know, and I was kind of, me and Lance were in the boat together. Because you know we're fishing together trying to figure this lake out, and I kept looking back behind me, and I'd see these splashes every once in a while, and I'm like hey Lance, have you seen that back there? Like there's, and it's out in the middle of the lake, and we do have a depth finder that we carry with us, you know, a little portable one, and it was in about 100 feet of water. You know, we were trying to work the stuff that was about 10 or shallower, you know, thinking that light penetration would give us the advantage of working along the edges. But no, these fish just wanted to be high up in the water column and out in the deep water. And that, you know, we looked back there and so like, well, let's go check it out. It's practice. We need to figure out where these fish are. So we motored out to the middle of the lake, and sure enough, that's where those fish were. And so it had not been for us keeping, you know, heads on a swivel, looking around, always looking out for more fish, that was a benefit to us and worked well.
And you got into them on like on the surface, or how'd you get into those?
Yeah, no, they were subsurface, but you know, within that really 2 foot of water column just under the surface.
Yeah.
And, you know, big, bushy type flies worked well, a lot of flash, lighter in color, and a pretty quick retrieve. They wanted it fast, surprisingly, in that off-color water. I was kind of surprised at their behavior. So,
and a pretty quick retrieve would be kind of like just strip, like what would be a
exactly
quick...
maybe even slightly faster. So like strip.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And they were hammering it.
There you go. And fishing the big stuff. Cool. What about time? Greg had a question about this one. Time, best time to fish a lake, kind of light temperature, that sort of stuff. What are you thinking about? You know, you're coming to a new lake. You know, should you be getting out there at the crack of dawn, or what's that look like?
Well, it depends on time of year. Obviously, crack of dawn, winter time, probably not the best. Crack of dawn in the summer, probably your best time, or evening. But as I tell everybody, you know, rivers included, however, obviously their temperature can be a very different thing. They got to feed constantly. One thing about lakes is they do have that, they can move out of the warmer temperatures and drop down into the cooler stuff. So you get that thermal climb. So you can track them as they descend into the water column, you know, finding the more optimal temperature zone. So that's one way you can do it. So you can fish for them all day long. However, you know, the temperature does affect vegetation growth. So that may limit you as to what you can access into the lake. If it's warmer and you got a lot of weeds, it's hard to pull a fly through the weeds. We haven't quite mastered that ability to work flies and keep them completely weedless. Yeah. So your mornings or evenings when the fish come back up, as it cools down, you lose light you get lower light conditions. Those might be your more optimal scenarios. But, you know, you get your spring or fall time frames all day long. You know, you just got to find where they're moving to. They may move up and down a few feet, just adjust. Again, that's where your different sinking lines come into play to keep you in the zone of where the fish are.
Once you find that zone. And once you find that zone, do you find that they're in it for a good part of the day? You know, say you find them, they're at 8 feet down.
They may be there anywhere between, you know, depending on what your temperature fluctuation is like, anywhere between 15, 20 minutes to, a couple hours. You know, they'll hold in that zone. Or if a hatch starts coming off, that can change as well. They may be down deeper, and then all of a sudden, you know, they're up in that upper 2-3 feet of the water column, you know. So again, not just necessarily getting down deeper is always the case, having to come back up and switching to a lighter line may be the difference too.
How deep, I mean, if you think, how deep have you caught fish? Like, can you go like way down in some of these deeper lakes?
I've done this was weird in where were we? Czech Republic, I think. I was fishing an intermediate tip line, the Rio one. I can never remember the name of these, but it had the little 3 foot intermediate sink tip on it. And I was doing a 30 count with two woolly bugger, humongous type flies. They were big. They were like a size 8 with a 4 mil bead on both of them. So real heavy, heavy rig. So a 30 count. You know, I was probably down 35, 30 feet max, you know, and it was a really slow retrieve to stay down. And that's where I was catching fish. I won that session by staying down really, really deep. You know, so that's been probably about the deepest I've had to go. Maybe our regional in Utah, Idaho, that was Daniels Reservoir. I know we were having to go pretty deep when we were fishing the dam side of the lake. The inlet side, we're staying in that first 3 feet majority of the day. You know, really stripping a lot of the blank savers and that sort of thing through. That was doing pretty good for us. But yeah, once we got towards the dam side, it was a lot of us were finding fish deeper. Full sink, type six. We're dealing with heavy winds too. Yeah, we're dealing with heavy winds. That was an interesting venue and conditions we were dealing with. We were dealing white caps.
Wow.
Like 30, 40 mile an hour gusts. It was fun.
Holy cow. That's it. Where would you say if somebody wanted to dig further into still waters, where's a good place people can go get some resources? Where would you send them? Anything else, books or anything that you recommend?
Nobody really has a book.
I was going to say, from you, it's interesting because you guys are kind of creating some of this stuff, right? I mean, you're...
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, but I would, you know, anything that Phil Rowley...
Yeah.
What's his name? In Canada.
Yeah, Phil and Brian Chan.
Yeah, exactly. Great guys. Great. They do dial in a lot of that, basically the ecology and the behaviors of trout in lakes, which is, you know, going to be very key in you locating them. If you know the behavior, you'll be able to dial it in a lot better. But, you know, do spend a lot of time in the Coronamid realm. That's kind of, you know, they developed in the BC area with suspension rigs. But they have started, and I've noticed a lot of what they've been doing has been related to a lot of the UK techniques or what we've been doing in competition. So they're factoring a lot of the attractor type patterns, your humongous, your blobs and all that stuff. So very, very good sources. I think Fly Fish Food, obviously with Lance there, they've targeted and started to work a lot more on still water stuff. So their videos are another good source. And, you know, I got a few videos on my YouTube channel that you can check out.
Oh, nice.
But I need to dial it in and be a lot more comprehensive on what I'm doing on the Stillwater. So I don't get a ton of time on the Stillwater myself personally these days, but it's fun. I do love Stillwaters. I need to get more time on the lake.
Today's episode is sponsored by Fairflies, founded with the idea of finding ethical solutions to fly tying materials and products. They've done just that by creating jobs for marginalized groups both in the U.S. and abroad. They are experts, innovators, and artisans of exceptional fishing products. I've noted that I've connected with Jeff a number of times a while back, and we had a connection right at the front, and it's been a good time now finally putting this together and hearing the story. We had Jeff on a podcast, and we heard about their 5D brushes and what it's all about, why brushes are a game changer in the fly tying space, making things faster, easier, more consistent, and they got it going. So the nice thing about what Fairfly has going is they've got not only the materials, but they got tools going now. Now they own Wasatch Custom Angling Tools and are carrying on the tradition of hand-making heirloom quality fly tying tools. With over 50 tools, this is truly the do-it-yourself company. You can get all your tools and fly tying materials right now. That's wetflyswing.com/fairflies, FAIRFLIES. Check them out right now. You support this podcast by checking out that link to Fairflies. Okay, back to the show. This has been a good little episode. And we've had Phil and Brian and some the Fly Fish Food guys on. So I'll put some links to the Phil's done some good stuff on Stillwater. That's who I was up there in BC with. And we did the indicator thing, which was pretty amazing. The slip bobber or whatever,
right?
Cool. Well, I wanted to you were gonna get out here in a little bit, but I wanted to, you know, for the Euro nymphing stuff, I want to dig into that here in a second, but before we get there, we're doing a little segment. We're giving away some free flies to a few winners. We're doing this top fly challenge. I just want to give a shout out to that at wetflyswing.com/topfly, and it's kind of deal real simple. Just kind of choose your favorite pattern, and then we got some boxes to give out. But if you talk about your top fly, we're talking Stillwaters. You mentioned a bunch of, if you had to pick one, what would it be?
My favorite pattern would be a humongous. I'd say that the kind of the classic silver and black. I fish that fly a lot.
Yeah, humongous. And what size typically?
Size 10 is a good size 10 hook anyway.
Hook. I'm just, and that's one I hadn't. Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, that's with a huge tail. Yeah, I see it.
Yeah, you see it.
Nice. Yeah, giant. I mean, that tail for sure is 3. I'm looking at the Fly Fish Food. They've got one on their site. Yeah. This one's got kind of a green, kind of a black tail. Lots of flash, looks like, and then a, kind of a greenish body.
Yeah, so the flashaboo on it is pretty heavy on the underneath, and yeah, it's got that silver tinsel chenille or crystal like that
tinsel,
and yeah, so it's a very, very bright, or can be bright.
That's it.
But
so, do you have a top fly story that goes along with that fly? Do you have any memories of one that you know what I mean? You probably caught a few fish on that thing.
Yeah, man, caught a lot of fish, and I think the initial when I just first saw it, it just looks very unproportioned,
Yeah, it does. It
or
looks
very
weird.
poorly proportioned,
Yeah.
but you look at this fly in the water, and it just swims, pulses, dives up
Yeah.
and down, and just has a lot of life to it. So, yeah, when we first started fishing it, man, it was just kind of a very very productive start to
Yeah.
utilizing the fly. We were just blown away by it. So,
Does it have bead chain eyes on it?
they do tie them with bead chain most of the time. So bead chain or dumbbell eyes aren't allowed in competition. We're only
Oh.
allowed just round beads or slotted beads. So I tie most of mine just with regular beads on them, tungsten beads.
Yeah, tungsten.
Tungsten, you can tie them in brass or even plastic. So just depending on what type of sink rate or movement you want on that fly. The lighter the bead, obviously it'll pull or move through the water a little more flat. So the
Yeah.
tail being that long, it still has a lot of movement, a lot of wiggle in it. But you throw a tungsten bead on it, then it has more of that dive, that up and down motion. So take that into account when your time flies for still water.
This is great. So your fly box, if you open up your box with, I mean, what does it look like? Do you have like a bunch of different sizes and weights of this one fly in all your flies, or how you must have like a bazillion boxes?
Yeah, so our leg boxes are, I found these cool pencil boxes at a craft store, and so I made them myself. They're about the size of, I think they're like 7 by 9 or something like that, 6 by 9, and filled them with foam. So anyway, I have 3 of those. I can't find those boxes anymore. And then I have several other bigger, slotted foam style boxes, basically 8 by 11s, I think. I have that with chironomids. Then I have another box that has like my dabblers and kind of like what you would imagine kind of classic lake style flies would be, which actually do work well. So the old school flies like Invictus, Bloody Butchers, all those types of patterns. And then I have the lure box, which has again all the woolly bugger type patterns in there, which also span into like your mohair leeches, damselfly patterns, and that's just, yeah, there's a lot of flies that you carry around for a lake session. And then you have your other box with the boobies and the blobs and the fabs and all
Right.
that stuff in there, worms even. So yeah.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. I know the boxes are great. When we were up there with Phil and Greg, I mean, yeah, they had a boxes just like their chironomid boxes. And they were just loaded with all, colors, sizes, weights.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of daunting. But we'll keep the humongous. That's perfect. So that's one I don't have in my box. I'll definitely get that in. And that's probably a good one the kids can. We can throw out there and have them troll that thing, or not troll, but we'll have them
It
strip.
works well. I mean, it's funny because I was just, of course, talking smack about trolling, but that's what we do when we locate. If we have a boat, we're all right, well, let's go check out this other point. Shoot, we'll just throw out a bunch of
Yeah,
line, strip out like
exactly.
all the way to our backing and just,
Yeah,
Keep the flies in the water.
totally. That is a pretty good feel. I do like that feel when you're doing it. You got a bunch of line out, and all of a sudden the fish is on stripping off line.
Exactly. And one thing too, I mean, you catch fish, you're like, I should remember that spot next time. There
Yeah.
might be something there, either a high point underwater that you can't see, maybe there's a spring or something. So, it's keep your flies in the water, it helps you dial it in a little bit.
Definitely. Definitely. Nice. Well, before we get out here, I mentioned that on the Euro, I also want to check on one thing, and I might be off, but I think I saw something there. You have some like kind of Native American or indigenous cult. Is that some of the background you have there?
Yeah, so I am of Pueblo descent, which are it's the indigenous people here in the Southwest, or one of the indigenous people in the Southwest. So our culture, the Pueblo culture, so I'm from San Felipe Pueblo, Laguna, and Hopi. So my
Oh,
mom,
okay.
she's from San Felipe Pueblo, and in our culture, it's matrilineal. So we take our mom's side of pretty
Oh,
much
wow.
everything. So I'm affiliated with San Felipe side as well as her clans. My dad, being Laguna and half Hopi, I do acknowledge those when we're talking to family or whatnot. So, just as an example, my mom, she's Eagle Clan, And my dad is Parrot Clan. So how I would reference who my parents are is I'm Big Eagle, Little Parrot. Hmm. So they know that your mom is Eagle Clan and your dad is Parrot. So that's how you reference your lineage. As well, you know, you don't intermix with those other clans. So it keeps the bloodline healthy. So, and you know, as another side note, my fiance, she's from Okeawinge, which is northern part of north of Santa Fe, and she's so it can get very complicated very quick. But so that's northern, that's Tewa. My mom or San Felipe and Laguna were Karis speaking Pueblo people. She's from a Pueblo that speaks Tewa, which are two different, completely different languages. And they don't have the clan system there. So, and they're patrilineal, so they take the dad side, but they don't have the same clan system as I do. So it can get very, very crazy and very complicated. But
and that's in the same, and that's two groups in the same area.
Within an hour away from each other, exactly. Wow. So the culture is the same, the ideologies. You know, how we reference a lot of our cultural components are pretty much the same. The language is different, but then you have these different, these subtle differences in how we either acknowledge our lineages or, you know, how just different spins and twists on things. Yeah. And that goes way back to, you know, when we're all pretty much one people and diverging and trying to find our way in the world of, you know, through ecological situations, climate changes and all that stuff, you know, so a lot of influence on our culture, on our evolution as people in this area by our environment, you know, so we're definitely keyed and tied tight to our world.
Yeah, your area, probably a pretty close knit area down there in that part of the world, right?
New Mexico. Yeah, exactly.
We had a recent episode. I'm always interested because, you know, we had Indie Fly on, and the Wind River. You know about that stuff going on?
Yeah. So I know Darren very well. I know. I think it was Matt mentioned Darren, working with Darren a little bit on the Wind River. He owns the whitewater rafting and guiding service.
Oh yeah, totally.
In the canyon there below Boisen Reservoir. He's a good buddy of mine, and I saw if you all want to learn a little bit more about that area, check out Tribal Waters video of Patagonia. Very good video.
Nice,
it's an awesome video. So it definitely touches on the cultural and indigenous stewardship aspect, you know, in fisheries as well as just water conservation. So
right, that's a huge I love that you brought the Tribal Waters. I'll put a link to that one for sure to watch that. That's and that's a cool thing, you know, and I think that's a struggle, is that I think that might have been a question I asked, you know, as you dig into it. It's interesting because you do have challenges, right, with some of these reservations and stuff with kids, but getting them able to become guides, right? I mean, you're a guide. I mean, what would you, when you look at that, do you see that as a pretty amazing opportunity to give some of these kids? I'm not even sure. It sounds like maybe you're not on the reservation, but are there reservations and things like that nearby your area?
There is. I mean, I didn't grow up on the reservation, so, you know, I was definitely given a lot of different opportunities there. But even still, from tribe to tribe or indigenous people to indigenous people, it's not all the same because the cultures are different themselves, you know. So it can be a little tough to get out of this pan-Indian type aspect of, you know, we're all the same, or we all live in the same kind of situation. Pueblo people, one great thing for us, as opposed to like Shoshone or Arapaho or your more nomadic tribes, is we were sedentary. And so, you know, when we had to come under the Spanish rule, ultimately into the U.S. government and all that, you know, we had already been established in this area for a long time before then. So we weren't getting moved out of our food sources or out of our traditional lands. We just had to stay. We might have been relocated slightly in a different area. That was a little bit easier for the Spanish to keep an eye on us. But, you know, farming, agriculture was our subsistence way of life. So, so we were able to cope with it a little bit better, as well as to hold on to our culture a little bit better. So, you know, that has a lot to do with the health and kind of the the integrity of our people. It's not to say we don't suffer from the same issues, you know, poor health, diabetes, alcoholism, you know, suicide rates, all that stuff. You know, it does affect us quite a bit still. However, you know, because going from a traditional way of life or growing up that way and trying to make it into a Western culture, Western society, it's a struggle. You know, that can be tough. But one great thing about Indigenous cultures is normally there's it's a family based culture, you know, so you have a lot of support from your family, which can be good and bad sometimes. You know, if you're trying to make your way outside of that, you know, they're wondering why you're leaving home.
Right. Yep.
But, you know, or you have the other where they want you to go out and you know, find your way in this world. So luckily I had the support of my parents that were like them. You know, they moved off the reservation to find how to live in this world. And they did the same thing for me as far as giving me those opportunities and supporting those opportunities for me to travel and experience the world, which, you know, in truth, a lot of our culture is based on that, you know, our what we call our migration stories and that sort of thing. It's because people left to go find something different or better, or, you know, to travel the world or this world that they knew. So that got us to where we are now. So I don't know, a lot of things going on this world that I could touch base on based on our culture, you know.
I know, it is good. I'm always interested in it because it is a crazy, cool, you know, amazing history of this, you know, this country and lots of places around the world, you know, and it's,
right.
I always love to give a shout out. People probably gonna get tired, but Superman, if you haven't heard of him.
No, I don't know him personally, but I know his work, and but tons of new artists coming out. And
there's a lot of good stuff coming out.
Yeah. That's so great. If you haven't noticed or listened, but what is it? Snotty Reznos Kids and Travis Thompson. My daughter, she's a big Travis Thompson fan.
Okay. Nice.
But But anyway.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I love to get, that's one of those things occasionally, if I get some music out of the guests, it's awesome because I'll get a video to, then we can expand our listening. So we'll get some Travis Johnson in there somewhere.
Yeah. Travis Thompson.
Yeah, Thompson.
He's in your area, actually. He's in Seattle, right?
I'm down in Oregon, but yeah, pretty close.
Oh, yeah, Oregon. So, yeah, he's up in the Northwest. I think he's out of Seattle.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, that's good. We'll do that. And, well, I think I'm feeling pretty good about this. What do you think about doing just a quick little rapid-fire Euro-nymphing tips? We've had a ton of Euro-nymphing. You know, like I said, we talked about a lot of the people that have been on here, but it's always good to do a refresher if you know, the quick Euro-nymph. So Euro-nymphing 101, what are some tips you tell somebody? They got all their gear, they're heading out, they're a little bit scared because they're not sure about casting the line, the leader. Right, what do you tell them?
So, you know, start out with your casting. You do want to accentuate and exaggerate that oval. So as you start to lift or initiate your casting, keep it a little bit more off to your side. And as you come back behind you, come over the top, over the head. So you're creating that oval shape, keeping that those flies from tangling. So if you do your traditional back cast where you come straight up and then come straight forward, again, you know, the whole thing about back casting is you want to stay in as true of a plane as possible. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen as efficiently with the Euro setup, typically because you have to have a softer rod, but more or less your leader, it typically doesn't have the same taper as you would with a standard tapered leader. It's very thin in diameter, has a little bit harder time transferring energy from the rod down the line to your flies to turn over. So you get a lot of hinging in portions of the cast. So starting off your side and then coming over the top on your forward stroke helps keep those from tangling as much. And then, you know, as you start your drift, keeping contact with your flies, as soon as your flies touch the water is key. So, you know, not bringing and letting your line settle totally on the water, but stopping just slightly above the water with your rod tip or a little bit higher. Helps keep that contact with your line or keep your line straight, but also you're able to see your sighter much quicker and determine your height of the rod to maintain contact as you go through the drift. So as soon as your flies hit the water, be ready. There's no setup time with Euro-nymphing. That's the whole intention of your nymphing, is when your fly's in the water, you're fishing. So as soon as they hit the water, be ready. You don't know how many times I've had fish eat as soon as that fly hits the water. Or as soon as your flies leave the water, you do that little hook set at the end of your drift to initiate the cast, one, but also to check, because as your flies start to pivot and swing under the cider downstream, there's a little bit of slack there that makes it difficult to read off the cider or even fill. And that brings me to my next point. With your nymphing, don't rely on filling the strike. Filling the strike is a point that's always stressed in a lot of videos that I see nowadays. You're still missing probably about 60% of the strikes, if not higher, if you're trying to wait and fill. Because like an indicator, by the time that fish pulls the indicator down, without you're seeing visually, because it, you know, if you're doing an inline rig, it takes your fly, it has to transfer, the tension has to transfer through the weight up to your indicator. You're delayed, and by the time you see that indicator go down, most of the time, I 100% feel it's the fish trying to get the fly out of his mouth.
Yep.
So when you set, you're already way behind. So same thing with filling the strike when you're urine and finger tight lining. By the time you fill it, you know, that's the moment that your line has gotten tight and transferred down the rod to your hand, or down the line to your hand. You're behind the hook set. Watch that cider straighten out, tension up, dip a little bit, read the cider more, pay more attention to that than trying to wait and feel for the strike. You'll increase your hookup ratio. I've worked with a lot of guys who compete and, you know, got them tuned in to seeing what's happening to the cider, and it's helped them increase their catch rate. So, and as well as their, you know, hookup to landing ratio, that's huge, you know, especially in a competition, you need to land your fish.
Yeah.
So if you're that much more in tune to setting the hook when you need to, you get a lot better hook set, rather than, you know, again, if they're trying to get that fly to the mouth, you're just on the very edge or fringe edge of the lip. So let's see what else. You need to order some HDA Fay variants from Umco Feather Merchants. That's a fly pattern that I've designed for them.
Oh, okay. What's it called?
HDA Fay variant.
Okay.
Yeah, so I am the fly designer for Umco Feather Merchants. So I have the HDA Fay Puerto Chingon, which is a Perdigon pattern, and the Chingon is kind of for Hispanic people or people in the Southwest. It means like it's you know, that flies the shit. So
yeah, nice.
So it's a play on the Perdigon, Perdigon.
Chingon, right. Chingon. I've heard that
people
before.
A little, they wonder how to pronounce it, but yeah, Perdigon Chingon. So that's another Euronymph pattern that I have out. And ICU Midge, low water betas is the one dry fly that I have in that mix too. So it's intended for kind of that flatter, more picky fish situation. So
yeah,
let's see what else as far.
Yeah, there's so many. I mean, I'm thinking if we get, say, we got our little 4 or 5 Euro tips to take us out of that.
I guess one other one, as far as your depth, like, you know, between your cider and your flies, one that I stress is always keep the distance between my flies. I normally just run 2 flies. So between my dropper and my point fly is always going to be about 20, 24 inches.
Okay.
I want enough distance. So if I hook a fish on the dropper and I drop it, I'm not foul hooking it with the point fly.
Right.
It does happen on occasion, but that reduces the amount of foul hooking you may have. If they're closer together, it happens a lot more often. So the distance or the variable that you can change is going to be from the bottom of your cider. Most people have tippet rings down there at the bottom of the cider. To your dropper, that can be the distance that you want to adjust and change depth with. So, you know, when you get to the river, or if you get to an unknown river, I always hold off in setting up my rig, so I can look at the depth or gain an idea of what the average depth could be. Most of the time, I start 2 feet, and that can cover most rivers in the Southwest or most fishing situations, truthfully, because, you know, certain depth of water produces a lot that I find anywhere that I fish. You know, it could be just from a few inches deep, enough to cover the fish's back, down to about 2 feet. You know, that's going to be a zone, or 3 feet of a zone that I feel really, really confident, comfortable fishing in, that I know fish will be holding in most situations, unless you're dealing with cold water or big rivers, you know. Then you may need to go deeper. So 2 feet is a good start for me. But again, a lot of times if it's new territory or a new river, I hold off on setting up until I look at the water. So let's say if I went to the San Juan, there's a lot of deeper sections in there. I would go from my sighter to my point, my dropper fly, sorry.
Yep.
Sighter to my dropper, I might lengthen that out to 3 feet.
Okay.
Because you don't necessarily want your sighter in the water all the time, because it's typically a slightly thicker or thicker diameter tippet thing, or what you're running to your flies. It creates a little bit more drag when it's in the water. You can drop it in to kind of just fill out what's going on down there under the water. If you need to go down, you know, a foot or even less than that, 6 inches, 8 inches, depending on, you know, how you have your sighter set up, to let you know how, what your depth is you're achieving by lowering the rod and dropping the sighter into the water. Then you can kind of get an idea, drop it in a little bit more, boom, you get a hit. You may need to go a little longer between your tippet ring and your dropper just to stay in that zone better. Again, it's all about staying in the face of the fish.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, so that's basically, yeah, below your sighter, your tippet ring, you got, you know, 24 inches, 36 inches. Then below that, your dropper, you got your lead fly, another so 24 inches. So you have like 4 foot leaders essentially.
Exactly. That's a good base to start with. And that keeps you in the zone in a lot of, again, in that shallower water, you know, that helps to keep both flies in the water itself. You know, again, a couple tips here. If you're in shallow water, keep your rod angle lower, but lead more, keeping the tension on the flies. If you go more vertical, and typically a lot of times that water type is a little bit faster moving anyway, again, transitions from a shelf or a shallow riffle, you know, dropping into a pool, that sort of thing. So you can pull your flies just slightly or accelerate your rod speed a little bit more through the drift. If it's a little bit deeper, a little slower, then your rod is going to go more vertical, but you don't have to worry about pulling your dropper out of the water when you go more vertical to keep your tension, keep your connection to your flies because it's deeper, you know?
Yeah.
So in the shallower water, you don't want to go too vertical to bring your dropper out of the water, unless you want to keep that dropper right in the surface film, which I've done a lot because, you know, you have emerger sort of thing. So
right. That's cool.
Nymphing. Yeah. Your flies aren't necessarily intended to stay on the bottom. Your point fly is, that'll stay close to the bottom. You can use the dropper, and I set up with my heavier fly, or, you know, my point fly will be the heaviest if it is. But I intend to move my dropper up and down the water column, you know, to find where the fish are feeding. So that in mind. So I know Lance, a couple other guys on the team, they do rig differently. They may have their dropper as the heavier fly and their point fly is lighter, you know.
Gotcha.
But it just depends on your preferred method.
Right. So on this one, your heavier fly is your dropper or your point fly?
My point fly.
Yeah, your point fly.
If it is heavier. And that being said, your point fly doesn't always necessarily to be a super heavy type fly. I run a lot of rigs where both flies are the same size bead, same weight, basically. Yeah. And, you know, trust that your flies are getting down. A lot of folks, they're, because they don't either, they don't feel the bottom, or they're not sure, or they don't have confidence that they're on the bottom, tend to go too heavy on their point fly. And because they don't feel it necessarily, they start lowering the rod, trying to add more tippet down underneath. Do the reverse, lift your rod higher, get tighter to your flies, and you'll register those strikes a lot better too. So tons of tips. I mean,
yeah. You know, those are great. Okay. We'll add them up, and we'll put a little list in the show notes.
Just like boom, 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 boom.
We got at least, I think we're getting close to 10. So we're good there. This has been awesome. Nice. Well, I think we'll let you get out of here. Where should we send people if they have questions for you?
Look for me on social media, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. I'm there as well. You can send comments on all of those or direct message. Anamaktima Fly Fishing.
Yep.
So Anamaktima Fly Fishing, all spelled out.
There you go. Perfect. Well, we'll cover all this. Like we said in the show notes, I'll have links out to your Instagram and your YouTube channel. And yeah, I think this is, we covered it. I feel good about the still water. I love that we touched on, you know, talked about woolly buggers, you know, and that's really cool. You know, it's old school for me, so that's great.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, like I said, like a lot of flies that evolve and have, You know, they all start families with themselves, like chubby, like Chernobyl yeah. ants. You know, you get all these different evolutions right. of your pattern. So these are varying styles of a woolly bugger, but yeah, it's a woolly bugger.
It's a woolly bugger. No, I love it. Well, it is the greatest fly of all time, right? That's pretty much the case.
Oh, yeah.
Nice, Norm. Well, thanks again for the time, and definitely appreciate you, you know, shedding some light on the Stillwater and the Euro tips. So we'll keep in touch with you, and hope to talk to you soon.
Yeah, definitely, man. Enjoyed it, and thanks for having me on.
So there you go. If you want to find the show notes, all links, and everything else we talked about today, you can head over to wetflyswing.com/348. 348 will get you some of those links. I know we talked about a number of good ones today. There's going to be at least a video or two you can check out. Plus, we'll have some links to our old podcast episodes we've referenced today. Norm mentioned his top fly. We dug into that a little bit, and that was part of this top fly challenge. Just want to remind you, you can go to wetflyswing.com/top fly, and you can enter to win a box of flies right now. That's the way to do it. Check it out right now. Jackson's giving out fly boxes this month and next month, so it's a good chance to get a shot. And if you want the bonus here is that I'm giving out a free big shout out on the podcast. If you want to tell me your top fly story, send me an email or DM quickly. I'd love to hear from you, and or just say hey. We'd love to hear, even if you don't do anything on that, just say hey. That would be amazing. Okay, I'm on the way out of here. It is a hot one. It's a hot one this week, so I'm going to try to stay cool, get in that cold plunge, and try to rejuvenate the body. I actually haven't done the cold plunge, but I've heard a lot about it. So if you've done a cold plunge, give me a shout out. I would love to hear if what it's all about, if it's good, if it helps your fishing, helps your fly tying. Let's hear about it. Okay, I'm going to let you get out of here, and we are going to move on to that next episode. Hope you are having a good morning. I hope you're having a good afternoon or good evening wherever you are in the world. Looking forward to catching you online or hopefully on the water.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.